Now, just continuing the timeline, Bob enlisted as a diver in the U.S. Marines, I guess, in his late teens, and that allowed him to dive all over the world and find just amazing wrecks in locations all around the world. For example, he found over 100 unexplored ships in Cadiz Bay in Spain. Continuing to move along, after a stint in the Marines, Bob moved to Cozumel, Mexico, the island off the coast of Cozumel, which was, you know, not at all a resort at the time, in 1954, and as I understand it, opened the first hotel there, which was really the first dive resort in the world. So we're talking a pioneer diver, right? This is all around the time at this point, probably before scuba even, or right around that time. 1959, a mere 5 years later, he moved to Seville, Spain, to study the archives of the Indies, where all of the logs of shipwrecks, the Spanish shipwrecks, were kept in great detail. Around that time, Bob started the other side of his career as a diver, which is to be an underwater archaeologist. He co-founded the Advisory Council on Underwater Archaeology. And in 1964, for the next 4 years through 68, was contracted with the Jamaican government to excavate a city called Port Royal that had been basically the main crossroads for the pirates back in the 15 and 1600s. And the most amazing thing happened to this place. A major earthquake and tidal wave caused Port Royal to break off and sink below the surface of the sea. This is on the coast of Jamaica in 1692. I don't know if that was a biblical curse or what, but at any rate, that kind of unbelievable event happened and left this pirate city submerged and in some ways untouched, you know, as a kind of a time capsule in 1692. So for 5 years in the mid-60s, Bob ran the operation to excavate that city, and we'll talk later with him about that and some of his other major adventures of his life and his career. By the way, and one of his divers during that period was a young lady named Jennifer, who Bob married in 1965, and she's been his partner and you know, in many of his different operations since then, and writes books, really beautiful coffee table type books, and a variety of scholarly books with Bob. And they both, again, live here in Melbourne Beach, or Indian Atlantic, I guess. In 1968, Bob moved to the Melbourne area, Bob and Jennifer, and he began working on the 1715 fleet, who people in the Treasure Coast are familiar with. 1972, discovered probably the second richest galleon lost by the Spanish in the New World, called the Mirabilis. Had about 10 times the treasure on it that the famous Atocha or Tocha wreck did. In 1981, I'm just hitting some highlights here out of these thousands of shipwrecks. In 1981, Bob found a Roman shipwreck near Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, off the coast of Brazil, which became very controversial as to what that wreck was doing there. And there was a lot of mystery and intrigue and international interest and activity around that. In 1992, Bob found the richest ship ever lost, as I understand it, at sea, the Flor do Mar, a Portuguese wreck or ship that sank in 1511 off the island of Sumatra in Indonesia. So these are just some highlights of an extraordinarily interesting and adventurous and successful career as an underwater archaeologist and explorer and treasure hunter. Bob Marks, welcome to American Variety.
I'm glad to be here.
What's the highlight of your if you can pick something out of these amazing series of adventures over, I guess, a 50-year period, what things stick out in your mind?
Actually, it wasn't a treasure find. The most important thing that I ever did to me was I built a replica of Columbus's ship, the Nina II, in 1962, and I duplicated a voyage across the Atlantic, completely authentic. The only thing that was modern on there was film and a camera and everything else. Even my logbook was made from pigskin, and I used a quill. We had no medicine, no compass, no radio navigation equipment, except just what Columbus used. And I spent 6 months doing it and wrote a couple books on it. And I like to think of that one of the best parts about it was I lost 44 pounds. We ran out of food. We almost starved to death. And the end result was that I got knighted by the Spanish government, made a knight commander in the Order of the Isabel the Catholic. And then a couple years later, I built a 10th century Viking ship to show how the Vikings discovered America. And that very much upset the Spaniards. And 4 years after that, I had another Viking voyage in a 10th century Viking ship.
Good Lord.
So the voyages, to me, are actually more exciting than just pulling up treasure all the time and working on sunken cities. Of the shipwrecks, the Roman wreck that I found in Brazil in 1981, somebody else actually found it, and I tried to prove it was a hoax. I didn't believe a Roman ship would be in Brazil, and it turned out it was a 2nd century B.C. Roman shipwreck. So although it had no treasure on it, it started a big controversy, and I literally got thrown out of Brazil over it.
And after you got, well, I think I remember that that one of the, let's see, the Minister of Antiquities or somebody was also the Vice President of Brazil at the time, and basically accused you of some sort of misinterpretation of the thing or whatever it was. There was some argument developed, and you were you and he got into a heated argument. And of course, he outranked you in Brazil.
Yeah, well, he was actually the Minister of the Navy and the Vice President of the country. They had a military dictatorship.
A guy with a little power.
Yeah, and what happened was when I proved that it was a Roman ship, it turns out that since 1946, over 2 million Italians have immigrated to Brazil, and they don't have very good rights. Like, they could only own 49% of a business because they weren't born in Brazil. So when I found the Roman wreck, the Italian government in Italy went to the Brazilian government and said, hey, these guys should have the same rights as the Portuguese, because the Portuguese allegedly discovered Brazil, and when Portuguese come from Portugal to Brazil, they get instant citizenship. They could own 100% of a business or a house, etc., and we want our guys to have the same rights. So this admiral said, I think you better change it. You better make it be a Phoenician or a Greek wreck. And I guess there's not many Lebanese and Greeks living in Brazil, so they wouldn't have that same hassle. And when I refused to lie and change the nationality of the shipwreck is when I was asked to leave.
That's probably a good example of the Byzantine politics and all of the extra, let's call it nonsense, to make it a generic word, that that comes into play in the treasure hunting business. And you've dealt with that all of your life, and each one of your major ventures has involved having to deal as much with that stuff as with the treasure. Let me come right back to it in a minute. You're listening to American Variety with Court Lewis, my guest Bob Marks, a renowned treasure hunter and underwater archaeologist, here on the Talk to Me station, AM 920 WMEL. Excuse me. If you'd like to call in to ask Bob a question, it's 254-2282 or pound 920 on your singular wireless. What happened to that wreck in the end? I mean, there it was, ready to be explored, you know, well, kind of something that affects the world history
up,
in a way.
We brought up a lot of artifacts to prove what kind of wreck it was beyond any doubt. Then the Brazilian government got a lot of pressure put on it by the Portuguese government and the Spanish government, and so they went out with a big dredge boat and covered the wreck over with mud.
Unbelievable.
And so 10 years later, for the 1992 quincentennial celebration, I got National Geographic and a lot of other power behind me to try to force them to let us excavate the wreck, promising to give 100% of what we found, and they wouldn't let us do it. They just want to leave history the way it is.
In the exploration of Port Royal, another kind of political imbroglio developed, right?
Well, there was a lot of problems like that. The big problem was I was working for one guy, Eddie Ciaga, who later became prime minister numerous times, and the opposition party kept claiming that he was selling the treasures that I was finding to finance his campaign funds. He was then the Ministry of Treasury when I was working there. So that was one of many, many problems that we had. And like a couple times I found slave bracelets and slave collars and stuff like that, and the government got very upset. I said, look, I can't help it. Slaves were brought over. And
they're politically incorrect.
You know, I mean, if I find it, I'm going to bring it up. So there were all those kind of problems all the time. And the other thing was they wouldn't give me any money for the project. The project got started because in 64, the year I started, the British government pulled out and Jamaica became independent. And I said, okay, I have a lot of money that Alcoa will give me, which was the biggest multinational company working in Jamaica at the time. They were taking out bauxite, which, of course, is used to make aluminum. Mm-hmm. And the government says, no, we don't want to look like we're poor. We're going to give you $1,000 a month to operate. That's my salary and salary for 15 people, $1,000. So consequently, they wouldn't let me take any money from anybody else. So I ended up spending my life fortune over the next four years plus. And finally, I got to the point where I didn't have any more money, and my wife got tired of supporting it. And I went to UNESCO, and I convinced UNESCO to shut down the deal where they couldn't dredge up the area. They were going to dredge up. This is how I forced them to let me do the project in the first part.
They were going to dredge Port Royal?
They were going to dredge Port Royal up to make a deep water port for cruise ships and other ships. Would have been destroyed forever. So UNESCO, United Nations, convinced them when I shut down the project not to ever do that. And so now they're talking about doing it again 30 years after I left.
Of course, that didn't endear you to the government of Jamaica.
No. But
you interceded to shut down their plans.
I seem to have problems around the world because I have my idea, which is right, and other people have their ideas. So,
but at the same time, you know how to get the job done.
That's
you're successful,
it.
And so they can't help but hire you in many cases.
Yeah.
I gather you've been a
But
consultant.
Usually I work on a good level. Like in Indonesia, I work directly with the Suhartos, the dictators. And Malaysia,
level.
I work with Prime Minister Mahathir, the dictator. Singapore, the prime minister, you know. In Spain, I taught the King Juan Carlos how to dive when he was a prince in exile living in Portugal. So when he became king in 1975, good. I was in like Flynn. And so I always try to stay on that big level. So if I have trouble with lesser people, I got the big daddies on the top to help me out.
How do you meet that level of people? Do they come to you, or do you find the shippers
and
go to them, or how does that work?
I go to them. When I wanted to work in Malaysia, there was no law. And I said, well, we need a law. And it dragged on for a couple of years. So finally I went to the embassy. I asked the ambassador to get me a meeting with the prime minister. They told me, okay, you got 10 minutes. Well, I took a slide projector and a couple trays of slides, and 3 hours later, the guy gave me the whole country. And he says, you write the law and we'll go for it. So that's how it works sometimes.
I would say you're an entrepreneur. Let me interject. I mean, there are probably hundreds, if not thousands, of people who dive on wrecks, kind of weekend treasure hunters and so on, and you've been diving as a professional diver and explorer, really. I mean, not a guy who works for a company putting in pilings in harbors, but you've been an explorer, treasure hunter, archaeologist type of diver your entire life and made a living at that, and in some cases an extremely good living at that, when very few people have been able to do it at all full-time.
Right. Amazing. Well, people think there's a lot of companies out there. There's a lot of weekend warriors, and there's, you know, probably a couple thousand people at any one time someplace in the world playing around with wrecks. But going on a two-week vacation for a shipwreck is not the same as working 12 months a year, which is what I do. And until I had a couple heart attacks 8 years ago, I was running 9 companies in 9 different countries. So every month I left from Melbourne to Atlanta to New York to Lisbon, then flew out to the Azores where we're working, back to Lisbon, to Seville, where I had work going on in the archives, then to Mallorca, where we were working on finishing Greek and Roman wrecks. But that wasn't just diving. That was deep water, so we were using submersibles and remote-operated vehicles. Then to Singapore, where I'd go up the coast of Malaysia. On one side, we had an operation working on Chinese porcelain wrecks. Back to Singapore, out to the Maldives in the middle of the Indian Ocean, where we were working on Portuguese and Dutch East Indiamen from the 16th, 17th century. Back to Singapore to Sumatra, working on wrecks in Sumatra. Back to Singapore to Hong Kong, then to Macau. We were working off of Macau. Then to California, we're working on a Manila galleon from 1595 lost in Drake's Bay, which is near San Francisco. In addition to that, I had things going on in Cayman, Florida, and Bahamas. So my life is virtually going on a plane, hitting the place for 4 or 5 days, diving, seeing what they're doing, making sure they're doing a good job, jumping on a plane, running around. Well, a couple of heart attacks slowed me down. So right now I have 4 operations going on around the world, which I monitor and run. And half the time I spend on Princess Cruise Lines lecturing to the passengers on the ships, and not just on treasure, but I have 110 different lectures, and I cover everything from the Bermuda Triangle to the sunken continent of Atlantis, the history of porcelain, maritime history of all these different countries, and, of course, treasures on land and the sea and the history of gold. So I keep busy, and then I also lecture a lot at universities, but mainly in Europe. I find it's more stimulating to me to teach kids in Europe. They're more on the ball, I find, than teaching somebody at the University of California who's going to fall asleep.
Well, you kind of have defined the kind of people we have on this show as amazing Brevardians. I mean, somebody who lives here, but basically their base of operations is the entire world. And I begin to understand how you could have discovered about 2,000 wrecks and dived on 3,000 or so.
Well, the interesting thing was,
your itinerary there a minute ago.
When Rio 8, the company that found all these 1715 wrecks, got started, they hired me as a consultant. So for the first 4 years, they had to come down to Jamaica because I was working at Port Royal. the sunken city 7 days a week.
Let me interject for our guest. Real 8 was the company that I guess Kip Wagner is most associated with, a Sebastian builder who first really realized that the 1715 fleet had come ashore up this way and that what's now called the Treasure Coast from Fort Pierce up through Sebastian rather than down in the Keys or so. So you've really covered all these bases over a 50-year period or so.
Anyhow, Bob. Kip invited me up here when they decided to go public, which meant they were going to sell stock. And the SEC said they needed a professional to run the company. So I said, okay, I'll come up for a couple months. And I fell in love with Brevard. That was back in 68, and here it is 36 years later, and I'm still living here. But I only came for a couple months.
We're glad you stayed. You're listening to American Variety with Court Lewis, my guest Bob Marks, here on the Talk to Me station, AM 920 WMEL. Let's talk, Bob, for a little bit about the Maravillas wreck, which was... what, the second richest Spanish galleon ever lost in the New World. What was the richest?
The richest wreck was the San Jose that blew up in a battle off of Cartagena, Colombia in 1708. Over $50 million have been spent since the late 60s trying to find it, but nobody's been able to find it. It's very deep.
Oh.
And
in the Pacific? Or
No, off of Cartagena, Colombia.
Okay. That's in the Gulf.
Yeah. In the Western Caribbean.
Right.
And so that hasn't been found, and the difficulty is usually we could find wrecks in deep water easier than in shallow water.
Huh.
But the bottom there is irregular, like we call it Grand Canyon, because it's all peaks of the seafloor coming up. And The rock there is a igneous rock, which makes it impossible to use a magnetometer, which is the main tool that we use that detects the presence of ferrous material. And the other thing, of course, is searching visually. And the water is pitch black down there off of Columbia in this particular area. So that wreck has never been found.
Do you think it's probably the richest wreck that's still to be found?
No, it's the richest wreck in the Western Hemisphere, Spanish wreck.
But, I mean, that's still to be found.
Right. But there's a richer wreck off of Brazil called the Santa Rosa, sunk in 1626. And it has somewhere between 40 and 80 tons of gold on it, gold coins and gold bars, very little silver. It was a Portuguese wreck. So I've had a couple companies trying to find it. Couple companies claim they found it, and then they never produced anything. A lot of the people in this business, the main deal is to seem to be swindling investors, which I don't go for.
Well, with all the wrecks you find, I don't think you have to stoop to that.
No.
So Bob has been a pioneer in addition to pushing the view of underwater exploration of wrecks as archaeology. He's also been a pioneer in the technology of that and in using submersibles and remotely operated vehicles in underwater archaeology. But let me get back to the Maravillas in 1972. How did you find that wreck? It was off the Bahamas, right?
Yes, the Little Bahama Bank. Actually, it's just 58 miles due east of Fort Pierce Inlet. And I looked for it for a period of 12 years, but not 12 years every day like Mel on the Atocha. I spent always the two best months, June and July every summer, then I worked elsewhere in the world on other wrecks. And finally, I found it with a magnetometer, but it turns out I actually found it the first day that I went out there. And for 12 years, I was looking for it, and I had already found it. What happened is, at that time, we didn't have GPS or anything.
You found it the first day, but didn't realize you'd found it until 12 years later.
There was nothing out there. There's no land. There's no reefs. There's nothing sticking up. The nearest land is a little rock called Memory Rock, 22 miles to the south. So I used a World War II wreck loaded with pipe as a place that I would start every day so I would know where I was, and we were using Loran. Loran was very primitive and very wild in those days.
So the pipe was a big signature you could start with.
Right, and as I would pull away from that wreck, testing the magnetometer before I would start each day, I'd get a reading a couple hundred yards away. Excuse me. And it turns out that was the Maravilla. So in 1972, we spent 3 months without ever going back to shore, and on the very last day, we pulled up the anchor, and stuck in the anchor was a couple of Spanish ballast stones.
Mm.
So that's how we found it, by a fluke, but I had found it 12 years before.
By a fluke, is that a pun on the anchor?
It's actually in the flukes of the anchor, right.
Yeah. Well, so once you found it, what did it look like? Described for
the first hole that I dug, meaning I blew the sand away and made a hole about 20 feet deep and about 60-foot diameter using a prop wash.
It was mostly under the surface of the sand.
Totally buried.
Yeah.
There was nothing visible.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing I grabbed on the bottom was a cannonball, and I have a geologist's pick, and I tapped and knocked the coral incrustation off of it, and it had the British broad arrow in it, which means property of the British crown. So that normally you'd say, okay, you got the wrong wreck, and something said, nah, you better dig another hole. And the next hole I dug suddenly was all these bronze cannons with Philip IV's name on and big clumps of silver coins and a gold bar in the second hole. Wow. So that's when we knew we had it. And that's when the trouble started.
As soon as you found the money, the sharks came around.
All of the sharks came around. We had pirates out there trying to take the treasure. The Bahamians tried to cheat us out of it, and all kind of problems.
Describe a couple if you can.
Well, we literally had people coming up with guns, machine guns, trying to take the treasure. The only catch was we had machine guns, too.
But you had to be out there 24-7 to guard your pile.
Or have two boats. So sometimes I switched around and had two boats. Always went on the site, right.
Did it ever come to shooting?
A few times. Now, I didn't shoot to kill, but I shot to show them that we were armed for bear, too.
And these were sort of modern-day Bahamian pirates. They were just,
in a couple cases, they were Americans.
Operators.
Actually, Americans. In one case, it was an American treasure hunting boat. They had looked for the Maravi for like 20 years and didn't find it. And they assumed that since they kept seeing me in this one area for a long, long time, that I must have found something good.
Well, they thought you'd want to share.
Yeah,
you're
of
a nice
course.
Guy.
Sure.
What did? How did the Bahamian government get into the act? I assume you can talk
about
that.
Well, first I had a permit. So the permit said 75 for me, 25 for them. Then after we found it, a couple rival treasure hunters, who I won't name, they went to Nassau and told the government, well, we'll do it for 50-50. So the Prime Minister Pinling of the Bahamas said, okay, to me, you can keep the permit, but you got to give me $50,000 a month while you're working.
Okay. I've got a better deal, but you got to bribe me to keep yours.
Right. And so we did it for like 6 months, and finally I said, the hell with that. And our State Department came to me and says, hey, Marks, that wreck is outside their limit. It's actually in international waters. You could tell them to go to hell. That it's typical with the government. They tell you to do something, then they don't back you.
I'm surprised, as shrewd as you are, that you didn't know that yourself, actually.
Well, some people claim 200 miles. The U.S. government only claims 12 miles. It was, as I said, further than 20-some miles from the nearest land, but it was on their platform. Their maritime platform.
Yeah.
There wasn't any deep water between my wreck and that island.
So it's kind of a gray area.
Yeah.
And of course,
so I told the Bahamians, I said, look, I told the Prime Minister, I said, I'm not going to pay you that money anymore. Let's go back to our original thing, or I'm just going to take 100%. And, of course, that's one of the troubles.
How big an army do you have?
Right. So they came out to arrest us. We escaped. We got to Fort Pierce.
Oh, my gosh.
Put all the treasure we had on board in a couple of banks. And then I went to the State Department. I said, okay, now you got me in this mess. Get me out of this mess. I got a lot of treasure over there waiting to be picked up.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you're on your own.
Well, you were in a different country or international waters.
Yeah, but they told me to do it.
Yeah.
And I did it, what they told me to do.
Huh.
So what I had to do was break that company down or get rid of that company, form a new company, and have people work for me, and I couldn't work over there.
Now, meanwhile, other people hadn't gone over and picked the bones of that wreck?
Some people did.
Yeah.
Yep. And then they claimed they found the stuff on different wrecks, you know.
And, of course, the government would be working with them as fast as they could, probably.
Right.
But anyway.
But the fact is that 95% of what was on the ship when it sunk is still on the ship.
Is that right?
And the most important object out there, in fact, the most important object on any Spanish wreck in the Western Hemisphere, there was a big problem in 1650 and 51. In Peru, they were counterfeiting Spanish pieces of eight, which are pure silver, using platinum. Platinum had no value. And when these coins circulated around the world, Spain was in big trouble because these coins were, like, not very good currency. So they had the assayer and mint master and different people in Lima beheaded, and the local merchants, to appease the king, had a life-size statue of the Madonna and Christ Child built. They sent it back from Lima, Peru.
Made of what?
Solid gold.
Solid gold. Life-size.
Yep. So they sent it back in 1654 from Lima on its way to Panama, which is the route. The ship sunk off of Chandui Reef, Ecuador. And eventually they rescued it, brought the treasure up and the thing. Then, of course, it was taken across Panama from Panama City to Portobello on the Caribbean side, put on the Maravilla, and lost on the Maravilla.
Lost twice. Unreal.
But there's a wreck that I'm working this summer down at Juno, which is by Jupiter down there.
Uh-huh.
And I worked on it in 88 and 89, called the St. Michael the Archangel. And that was a salvage ship of the Maravilla, and it sunk in 1659. And when we bring the coins up off that wreck, which we've been doing, these are coins that sunk three times. First off of Ecuador, then the Bahamas, then off of Florida.
They never got waterlogged. Bob, thank you so much for coming on American Variety. We've been listening to really an American legend and maybe an international legend, certainly in the diving field, Bob Marks, and certainly an amazing Brevardian. So thanks for listening. And next week, my guest on American Variety next Sunday will be Margot McKnight, who's the outgoing director of the Brevard Zoo. And we're here on the Talk to Me station, AM 920 WMEL. Thanks very much, and goodbye.
I blew it. I went about.
To final coordination and approval, the trials will be held at a location within this convention center here in Baghdad.
Calls for Donald Rumsfeld's book.